all I swear. They'll never know we're gone.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Is Democracy Now! More than 10 people have died. More than 10,000 homes and offices have been damaged or destroyed in the devastating Los Angeles fires. We'll speak to climate scientist Peter Kalmus. He fled LA 2 years ago, fearing that his neighborhood would burn down. Then we remember the life and legacy of Jimmy Carter.
He gave voice to dissidents, stood up to dictators, brought countries together in peace. His heart broke for the people of Israel. It broke for the people of Palestine. And he spent his life trying to bring peace to that holy land. And he talked about it at the dinner table. It was the same in public as it was in private.
We'll air excerpts from the state funeral for Jimmy Carter at the National Cathedral and speak to Ralph Nader and others about his legacy at home and abroad. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Southern California, firefighters are continuing to battle multiple wildfires raging around Los Angeles, which have now claimed at least 10 lives, though officials warn the death toll could continue to climb. This is L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna.
Based on the devastation that is clear, it looks like a bomb, an atomic bomb dropped in these areas. I don't expect good news, and we're not looking forward to those numbers.
A new fire, the Kenneth Fire, exploded Thursday evening in the West Hills north of Calabasas, quickly spreading to 1,000 acres. Meanwhile, the two largest fires, the Palisades and Eaton fires, were just 6 and 0% contained as of early this morning. Experts say the wildfires not only are the most destructive in U.S. history, but likely will be the most costly disaster as well. Over 10,000 homes and other structures have been damaged or destroyed. At least 180,000 residents are under evacuation orders. This is Alita Johnson, lifelong Altadena resident who lost her home in the Eaton blaze.
But nothing prepares you for this amount of destruction. I mean, there's no manual. There's no book. That night when we left, it was so frightening. You could barely see I could barely see my hand in front of me because the visibility was so bad and the winds were whipping just ferociously.
Boil water advisories have been issued in much of the affected areas, with only bottled water recommended for drinking. Meanwhile, health experts warn children, the elderly, and those with certain medical conditions are particularly vulnerable to health complications from inhaling wildfire smoke, which is filled with fine particulate matter. Red flag fire weather warnings are continuing today. Forecasters warn gusty, dry winds could return to the region as early as Sunday. President Biden linked the historic L.A. wildfires to the climate crisis as he vowed federal aid to cover 100% of disaster assistance costs over the next 100 days. This comes as new data from Europe's Climate Monitor confirms 2024 was the hottest year in human history, with the average global temperature rising by 1.6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's more than the 1.5 degree limit set by the United Nations 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with a climate scientist. In Gaza, Israeli forces bombed tents housing displaced Palestinians west of Khan Yunis overnight. It was one of several attacks that killed 70 people within 24 hours. That's according to Gaza's health ministry. This comes as a new study in the medical journal The Lancet finds the true death toll in Gaza may be 40% higher than official figures, which now stand at more than 46,000 Palestinians killed and nearly 110,000 wounded. Here in the United States, the House of Representatives voted to sanction the International Criminal Court after it issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former military chief Yoav Gallant for war crimes and crimes against humanity. 45 Democrats joined 198 Republicans to approve the, quote, illegitimate court counteraction act, unquote. In New York, 11 students have been suspended by New York University for 1 year for participating in nonviolent anti-war protests last month. In a statement, NYU faculty and staff for justice in Palestine called the suspensions a draconian case of collective punishment. Palestinian journalists in Gaza gathered for a news conference outside Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, where they decried the hypocrisy and neglect of international media organizations. This is reporter Abu Bakr Abed.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us, because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
To see our interview with Abu Bakr Abed, go to democracynow.org. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate reports nearly 200 journalists have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7, 2023. Over 400 others have been wounded or arrested. In more media news, the New York Times has come under fire after it refused to run a paid ad by the American Friends Service Committee that referred to Israel's war on Gaza as a genocide. The ad read in part, quote, tell Congress to stop arming Israel's genocide in Gaza now, unquote. Joyce Aljuluni, General Secretary of AFSC, called the move, quote, an outrageous attempt to sidestep the truth, adding, quote, Palestinians and allies have been silenced and marginalized in the media for decades as these institutions choose silence over accountability. The AFSC is a Quaker organization. President Jimmy Carter's state funeral was held Thursday at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. All five living presidents were there. President Biden delivered a eulogy.
Throughout his life, he showed us what it means to be a practitioner of good works and a good and faithful servant of God and of the people. And today, many think he was from a bygone era. But in reality, he saw well into the future.
Following the ceremony, Carter's body was returned to his hometown of Plains, Georgia, where there was a private funeral so he could be buried next to his wife of 77 years, Rosalynn Carter. After headlines, we'll continue our look at the presidency and legacy of Jimmy Carter. The Democratic Republic of Congo has banned Al Jazeera after it published an interview with the leader of the M23 rebel group, which recently seized territory in mineral-rich eastern Congo. M23, which has been accused of widespread, indiscriminate violence, took control of the town of Masisi last week, which is roughly 50 miles from the city of Goma. The UN said recent fighting in the eastern DRC had displaced over 100,000 people in about a week. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who's long been accused of backing the M23, called on Congolese officials to start negotiating with the rebel group. Planned peace talks between DRC President Felix Tshisekedi and Paul Kagame were called off last month after Congo's presidency said the Rwandan delegation refused to take part. Meanwhile, Amnesty International is calling on President Tshisekedi to immediately halt plans to execute 170 Congolese prisoners convicted of armed robbery and to abolish the death penalty. A number of European leaders are calling on the European Union to stop Elon Musk from meddling in national elections after the billionaire CEO hosted the head of Germany's far-right AfD party on his social media platform X. During Thursday's 75-minute virtual live encounter, Musk heaped praise on Alice Weidel and her far-right anti-immigrant party as it campaigns for German elections February 23rd. On Thursday, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez made a clear reference to Musk during a speech commemorating the 50th anniversary of the death of the Spanish fascist dictator Francisco Franco.
The international far right that we've been opposing in Spain for years, led in this case by the richest man on the planet, openly attacks our institutions, incites hatred, and openly supports the heirs of Nazism in Germany in the next elections to be held in the most important country in the European economy.
Meanwhile, in Austria, tens of thousands of people held protests in Vienna and other Austrian cities Thursday as the ultra-nationalist Freedom Party and its leader, Herbert Kickl, began talks to form a coalition government. President-elect Trump is being sentenced by a New York court today over his 34-count hush money and 2016 election subversion conviction, making him the first felon who will serve as U.S. president. This comes after the Supreme Court denied Trump's request to halt today's sentencing. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court ruled Thursday the Justice Department can release part of its report on Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Trump could still ask the Supreme Court to block the report's release. And a federal judge in Kentucky threw out the Biden administration's expanded Title IX rules, handing a win to Republican-led states as they carry out more attacks on transgender youth. The Education Department had sought to expand the longstanding federal policy protecting against sex-based discrimination in schools to include LGBTQ plus and transgender students, as well as pregnant people and survivors of sexual assault. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the devastating fires in Los Angeles, where at least 10 people have died. More than 10,000 homes and offices have been damaged or destroyed. Entire neighborhoods have burned down. The death toll is expected to rise. More than 35,000 acres have already burned. The fires continue to burn due to high winds and dry conditions. The largest blaze, the Palisades Fire, is just 6% contained. The Eaton Fire near Pasadena remains 0% contained. Analysts project the cost of the fires may reach a record $150 billion. The climate-fueled fires come as scientists at the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service have confirmed last year was by far the hottest year on record, with global temperatures exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times for the first time. We're joined now by Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. He's speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. He's just written an opinion essay for the New York Times headlined, "I'm a climate scientist. I fled Los Angeles 2 years ago." He joins us now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today. Explain why you fled Los Angeles 2 years ago.
Oh, Amy, I just have to take a moment to, I don't know what to say anymore. I'll get to that in a second, but I just want to make sure the reason I wrote the piece was because, we have to acknowledge that this is caused by the fossil fuel industry, which has been lying for almost half a century, blocking action. They're on the record saying that they will continue to, spread disinformation and continue to attempt to block action. They've known the whole time that the planet would get hotter like this and that impacts like this fire would happen. And then a point I really wanted to make in the piece, which they wouldn't let me make, is that this is still just the beginning. It's going to get way worse than this. 2 years ago, 2020, when that Bobcat fire happened, the whole time I was in living in Altadena, it was getting hotter and more fiery and drier and smokier. And it just didn't feel like I could stay there. Like I could, so, you know, when you have a trend line, things getting worse every year, right? Like, where's the point where it breaks? You know, like you keep going and keep pushing the system, getting hotter and hotter, getting drier and drier, right? Like, you know, emitting more and more carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. Eventually things break. I didn't expect, my neighborhood to burn this soon.
Explain what's happened, Peter, in Altadena, in the town that you left.
It's complete devastation. I mean, you're your audience probably has seen some of the images. The neighborhood I lived is gone. I would say the majority of my friends have lost their homes there. Every now and then there's a home that's still standing amidst the ashes and the devastation. I don't even know what kind of rebuilding after this is going to look like and feel like. I don't know how this is going to affect the housing market, the insurance industry going forward. It's the thing, again, you know, I think everyone needs to understand, and I wish the New York Times would have let me make this point, that this is going to get worse. I can see that today just as clearly as I could see how a hotter and drier and more fiery Los Angeles was getting. I mean, I think in the future, if we don't change course very quickly, and maybe it's even too late to avoid some of these much more catastrophic impacts, but I'm fully expecting heat waves to start appearing that where 100,000 people die, and then maybe 1 million people die, and then maybe more after that as things get hotter and hotter, because there's no upper limit, right? Like, we keep burning these fossil fuel industry keeps lying, the planet just keeps getting hotter, these impacts just keep getting worse. It's not a new normal. A lot of climate messaging centers around this idea that it's a new normal. It's a staircase to a hotter, more hellish earth. And you know, a lot of climate impact predictions have erred on the side of least drama. It's hard for even scientists to wrap our heads around how everything is changing right now on planet Earth. No matter where you look, the indicators, you know, when spring comes, how hot the winter is, habitats that are moving, ice that's melting. Everywhere you look in the Earth system, including, of course, ocean temperatures and land surface temperatures, you're just on this trend towards a hotter planet and all the impacts that are associated with it. And I don't know what it's going to take for us to stop all these stupid wars and come together and actually deal with the emergency that our planet is in the process of becoming less and less habitable and everything that means. We humanity, we've got a real crisis here and we're ignoring it. You know, another paragraph they took out of the piece, both the Democratic presidents, President Obama and President Biden, they were very proud to expand fossil fuels. President Obama said, you know, all that oil and gas expansion, that was me, people, right? Right after he was done being president at a lecture he gave at Rice University. And now, of course, we have a Republican president coming into office who says this is a hoax, who's gaslighting the people who are following him. Like, I don't know how long it's going to take for conservative working class people to believe what's right in front of their eyes, that the planet is getting hotter and that we have to come together and stop listening to these clowns who say it's a hoax. I mean, look at it's all around us. Why do I have to be on Democracy Now saying this? It's very obvious what's happening.
Well, Peter, we thank you for being with us. We're so sorry about what's happening there in your community and all over Los Angeles. And of course, we're talking about a heating world, so around the world. And we hope to have you on next week. Peter Kalmus is a
client. My heart breaks for all the victims, too. It's just I can't wrap my head around what's happening.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. We'll link to your piece in The New York Times. I'm a climate scientist. I fled Los Angeles 2 years ago. And just reading his last sentence of his op-ed, nothing will change until our anger gets powerful enough. But once you accept the truth of loss and the truth of who perpetrated and profited from that loss, the anger comes rushing in as fierce as the Santa Ana winds. Peter Kalmus, the NASA scientist, has been arrested numerous times for his climate change activism. Coming up next, consumer advocate, former presidential candidate Ralph Nader on the life and legacy of the late President Jimmy Carter. And then we'll go internationally to his legacy in East Asia as well as the Middle East. Stay with us.
is wrong. Let her pelt his song. Human beings do the right thing. Let freedom ring. It's been so long. Let's right this wrong. Let her pelt his song.
Leonard Peltier's song by I Rebellion. Many at the end of Biden's term are calling for Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader, to be pardoned. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with another man that many are calling on to be pardoned. But right now, we go to the national funeral of President Carter. President Biden joined with the four other living presidents Thursday for the state funeral of President Jimmy Carter. He died December 29th at the age of 100. After the service, Carter's body was flown back to his hometown of Plains, Georgia, where he was buried at his family's peanut farm next to Rosalind Carter, his wife of 77 years. She died in 2023. Speakers at the funeral included their grandson, Jason Carter.
He gave voice to dissidents, stood up to dictators, brought countries together in peace. His heart broke for the people of Israel. It broke for the people of Palestine. And he spent his life trying to bring peace to that holy land. And he talked about it at the dinner table. It was the same in public as it was in private.
Civil rights activist Andrew Young, who served as UN ambassador under President Carter, also spoke at the funeral.
James Earl Carter was truly a child of God, not only a good farmer, but a nuclear physicist chosen by Admiral Rickover to assist him in developing a new nuclear navy. But at the same time he was working on a nuclear navy, he was thinking of peace on earth and goodwill toward all men, and especially women and children.
To look more at Jimmy Carter's legacy at home and abroad, we're joined by three guests. But we're beginning with Ralph Nader, the longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate a number of times over. His most recent op-ed for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is headlined, Jimmy Carter Was My Last President. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader. Why do you say that?
He was the last president to actively encourage participation and involvement in governmental processes by the progressive civic community in Washington and around the country. I mean, he insisted on hearing from consumer advocates, environmental advocates, civil rights advocates, and he proved it. He appointed the best possible regulators for the Federal Trade Commission, Mike Perchuk, Joan Claybrook for the Auto Safety Agency, Donald Kennedy for the Food and Drug Administration, Doug Costal for the Environmental Protection Agency, and Carol Foreman, all kinds of leaders that would never be inside the government. They would be excluded. Their calls wouldn't be returned. They couldn't meet with the president of the United States. And so he really reflected his motto, why not the best? And he proved it. You know, we had a president who was rejected by the American people in favor of a grade B actor from Hollywood, Ronald Reagan, who dismantled just about everything that Jimmy Carter did. And put corporations in charge. So we have the lesson of Jimmy Carter now being conveyed to the American people at long last. And there was Donald Trump in the audience at the National Cathedral. What must be going through his mind? Must be going through his mind is this guy Carter was a lot different than I was. Donald Trump.
One thing for sure that President-elect Trump has commented on is that the flags will be at half staff during the inauguration, perhaps the first time ever, and he is very unhappy about that. But if you can elaborate more, Ralph Nader, on why you believe Jimmy Carter lost his second term bid for president. Of course, he lost to Ronald Reagan. And why you believe President Trump won for the second time.
Well, he lost in great part because he was sabotaged by his own Democratic Party. He was challenged by Ted Kennedy, of course, which is okay to have a competitive primary in 1980. But the Democratic Party sabotaged him in Congress. People may not remember that there was a majority Democrat control of Congress. They should have enhanced what he was doing. And they obstructed him all the way to defeating the Consumer Protection Agency, which was the prime goal of the consumer movement, which deals with health, safety, and economic well-being, after all. And this agency was going to intervene and challenge other federal agencies who were in a cushy relationship with their corporate patrons playing loose with their mission in the public interest and giving corporations what they wanted. And this agency had the power to take them to court. Well, it was defeated by the Democrats in Congress. And so that weakened his performance. I think Jimmy Carter's performance, Amy, illustrates the problem of the electorate. Period. That their expectations for what a president should do is very, very low. If you ask average people, what would you want from a president? They wouldn't tell you all that much. They say, well, he should be honest and keep us strong. But look what Jimmy Carter did that was ignored by the expectations of the people, which led to the Reagan landslide of Carter and the loss of many fine senators and representatives in the Congress. He deregulated cartels over the airline, trucking, railroad industry. His personal behavior was exemplary. He's as honest as presidents can come. He was stable. He read. He thought. He acted. He had an efficient use of his time. He paid attention to facts and realities, saw problems and wanted to treat them. He was okay with democracy. He was the first president to deal with renewable energy and warned about the climate issue, which people ignored. This is back in the 1970s. He observed the laws, which succeeding presidents have had a hard time doing. He pressed for arms control treaties. He wanted peace negotiations. He wasn't just shipping weapons to Netanyahu genocidal action or anywhere in the world. He wanted peace negotiations. And, of course, he kept saying things that brought the best out of people. Trump brings the worst out of people, which is a very, very bad trait.
Let me ask you more about the legacy of Carter's economic policies. In 1984, his former chief domestic policy advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt, who eulogized him yesterday at the state funeral, wrote a piece for the Washington Post headlined In Defense of Jimmy Carter. Eisenstadt wrote, quote, he began taking the Democrats into the new post-New Deal era. He did this by continuing to embrace the party's traditional social ideals while supporting fiscal moderation, less government intrusion in the economy, a philosophy of government that some now describe as neoliberal. He was strongly committed to fiscal moderation and government efficiency, pressed for tax reductions the nation could afford. It was Jimmy Carter, not Ronald Reagan, who began reducing the regulatory burdens on such industries as airlines, trucking, railroads, communication, and banks. Your last minute, Ralph Nader.
Well, I'm just saying that we should observe the lessons of Jimmy Carter here. We're being led by an unstable, ignorant, corrupt madman. Let's face it, he thinks climate change is a hoax, notwithstanding the fires, the tornadoes, the hurricanes, the rising sea level, the droughts, the floods. We're in a very perilous situation. The only institution that can counter it is the Congress. That's why we have this Capital Citizen newspaper to empower people to pay attention to Congress, summon to town meetings, senators and representatives back in your neighborhood, and show that under the Constitution, the Congress can turn the country around. There's nothing else left, Amy. The lawyers are AWOL in our country against the lawlessness of Trump. The norms are championed by religious groups. They're not there. The labor unions are weak. The citizenry is not organized.
Ralph, we're going to have to leave it there.
Congress is under the Constitution make Trump obey the laws.
We have to leave it there, Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, and former presidential candidate. This is Democracy Now! As we continue our discussion of President Jimmy Carter's legacy, we look at his policies in the Middle East and North Africa, in particular Israel and Palestine. Thursday, during the funeral, President Carter's former advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt, praised Carter's work on facilitating the Camp David peace accords between Israel and Egypt in 78.
Jimmy Carter's most lasting achievement, and the one I think he was most proud of, was to bring the first peace to the Middle East through the greatest act of personal diplomacy in American history, the Camp David Accords. For 13 days and nights, he negotiated with Israel's Menachem Begin and Egypt's Anwar Sadat, personally drafting more than 20 peace proposals and shuttling them between the Israeli and Egyptian delegations. And he saved the agreement at the 11th hour, and it was the 11th hour, by appealing to Begin's love of his grandchildren. For the past 45 years, the Egypt-Israel peace treaty has never been violated and laid the foundation for the Abraham Accords.
The Abraham Accords are the bilateral normalization agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and Bahrain, signed in 2020. In 2006, years after he left office, Jimmy Carter wrote a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, in which he compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians to South Africa's former racist regime. It was striking for a former U.S. president to use the words Palestine, let alone apartheid, in referring to the occupied territories. I went down to the Carter Center to speak with President Jimmy Carter about the controversy around his book and what he wanted the world to understand.
The word apartheid is exactly accurate. You know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. The Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except their Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance, except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other, and the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people.
Why don't Americans know what you have seen?
Americans don't want to know, and many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land. I think it's accurate to say that not a single member of Congress with whom I'm familiar would possibly speak out and call for Israel to withdraw to their legal boundaries or to publicize the plight of the Palestinians, or even to call publicly and repeatedly for good faith peace talks. There hadn't been a day of peace talks now in more than 7 years. So this is a taboo subject. And I would say that if any member of Congress did speak out, as I've just described, they would probably not be back in the Congress the next term.
President Jimmy Carter, to see that whole interview we did at the Carter Center, you can go to democracynow.org. For more on his legacy in the Middle East during his presidency and beyond, we're joined in London by historian Seth Anaziska, professor of Jewish-Muslim relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, a political history from Camp David to Oslo. What should we understand about the legacy of President Carter, Professor Anaziska?
Well, thank you, Amy. I think primarily the biggest lesson is that when he came into office, he was the first U.S. president to talk about the idea of a Palestinian homeland alongside his commitment to Israeli security. And that was an enormous change from what had come before and what's come since. And I think that the way we understand Carter's legacy should very much be oriented around the very deep commitment he had to justice and a resolution of the Palestinian question alongside his commitment to Israel, which derived very much from his Southern Baptist faith.
And talk about the whole trajectory. Talk about the Camp David Accords, for which he was hailed throughout the various funeral services this week and has been hailed in many places around the world.
Well, I think one of the biggest misunderstandings about the legacy of Camp David is that this is not at all what Carter had intended or had hoped for when he came into office. He actually had a much more comprehensive vision of peace in the Middle East that included a resolution of the Palestinian component, but also peace with Syria, with Jordan. And he came up with some of these ideas, developed them with Cyrus Vance, his Secretary of State, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, his National Security Advisor. And in developing those ideas, which came out in 1977 in a very closely held memo that was not widely shared inside the administration, he actually talked about return of refugees. He talked about the status of Jerusalem. And he desired very much to think about the different components of the regional settlement as part of an overall vision. This was in contrast to Henry Kissinger's attitude of piecemeal diplomacy that had preceded him in the aftermath of the 1973 war. So we can understand Carter in this way very much as a departure and somebody who understood the value and the necessity of contending with these much broader regional dynamics. Now, the reasons why this ended up with a far more limited but very significant bilateral peace treaty between Egypt and Israel had a lot to do both with the election of Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in 1977, as well as the position of Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat, and also the role of the Palestinians and the PLO. But what people don't quite recall or understand is that Camp David and the agreement towards the peace treaty was in many ways a compromise, or in Brzezinski's view, was a real departure from what had been the intention. And that gap between what people had hoped for within the administration and what ended up emerging in 1979 with the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty also was tethered very much to the perpetuation of Palestinian statelessness. So if we want to understand why and how Palestinians have been deprived of sovereignty or remain stateless to this day, we have to go back to think about the impact of Camp David itself.
Interesting that Sadat would be assassinated years later in Egypt. When Carter was on the plane with Nixon and Ford, that's when they say that cemented his relationship with Ford, while they hardly talked to Nixon at all. But if you could also comment on President Carter and post-President Carter. I mean, the fact that he wrote this book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, using the word Palestine, using the word apartheid to refer to the occupied territories. I remember him chasing him down the hall at the Democratic Convention when he was supposed to speak. This was the Obama Democratic Convention. And it ended up he didn't speak. And I chased him and Roseland because...
Remember that in 1977... there was a very famous speech that he gave in Clinton, Massachusetts, talking about a Palestinian homeland. And that raised huge hackles, both in the American Jewish community, amongst American Jewish leaders who were very uncomfortable and were already distrustful of a Southern Democrat and his views on Israel, but also Cold War conservatives who were quite hawkish and felt that he was far too close to engaging with the Soviet Union. And so both of those constituencies were very, very opposed to his attitude and his approach on the Palestinian issue. And I think we can see echoes of that in how he then was treated after his presidency, when much of his activism and much of his engagement on the question of Palestine, to my view, derived from a sense of frustration and regret about what he was not able to achieve in the Camp David Accords. And his commitment stemmed from the same values that he had been shaped by early on, a sense of viewing the Palestinian issue through the same lens as civil rights and the same lens as what he experienced in the South, which is often what his biographers have explained, where his views and approach towards the Palestinians came from, but also a particularly close relationship to biblical views around Israel and Zionism, that he was very, very much committed to Israeli security as a result. And that was never something that he let go of, even if you look closely at his work in Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Some of his views on Israel are actually quite closely aligned with positions that many in the Jewish community would feel comfortable with. The fact that people criticized and attacked him for that, I think, speaks to the taboo of talking about what's happening or what has happened in the context of Israel and Palestine in the same kind of language as disenfranchisement around a race in apartheid South Africa. And of course, as Carter said in the interview you just ran that you had done with him when the book came out, the situation is far worse in actuality with what is happening vis-a-vis Israel's treatment of Palestinians.
Seth Anazisko, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of Jewish-Muslim Relations at University College London, author of Preventing Palestine, A Political History from Camp David to Oslo, speaking to us from London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the late President Jimmy Carter is remembered as the human rights president. But as we continue our critical look at the life and legacy of President Carter, we turn now to Southeast Asia, where his legacy is more complicated. When I spoke to President Carter at the Carter Center in 2007, he discussed his regrets over sending weapons to Indonesia during its brutal occupation of East Timor.
I was wondering, in your time as president, the period that Indonesia occupied Timor, if you regret the allowing of Indonesia to buy U.S. weapons at a time when it was the one of the worst times for the people of Timor.
Well, as you may know, I had a policy when I was president of not selling weapons if it would exacerbate a potential conflict in any region of the world. And some of our allies were very irate about this policy. And I have to say that I was not, you know, as thoroughly briefed about what was going on in East Timor as I should have been. I was more concerned about other parts of the world then.
For more on President Carter's legacy in Indonesia and East Timor, we're joined by Brad Simpson, professor of history at the University of Connecticut, author of Economists with Guns, Authoritarian Development and U.S.-Indonesian Relations. He founded the Indonesia-East Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, which provided thousands of U.S. documents to East Timor's Truth Commission, which were used in its final report. Professor Simpson, thanks so much for being with us. Talk about the legacy of President Carter when it comes to Southeast Asia, and start with Indonesia's occupation of East Timor.
Thank you for having me on the show, Amy, and it's good to be with you. I think that we should recall that in 1975, the United States effectively pulled out of Southeast Asia just as Indonesia was invading East Timor with U.S. support on December 7, 1975, shortly after President Ford and then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger left Jakarta. Indonesia invaded East Timor. Over the course of the next year, they killed upwards of 10% of the population, an invasion that was entirely financed and armed by U.S. weapons. The CIA estimated that about 95% of the weapons used by Indonesia in its invasion were provided by the United States. And so when Jimmy Carter became president in January of 1977, he confronted an ongoing genocide, which many officials and journalists were already describing as the worst human rights crisis in the world at the time. And Jimmy Carter, like his top officials, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and Zbigniew Brzezinski, were primarily concerned with reassuring right-wing allies in the region, such as Indonesian President Suharto, Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, and the South Korean government, that the United States was still committed to providing military and economic assistance. And we see this right from the start, that when Carter was evaluating his policies towards Southeast Asia, his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, reassured his staffers that the Carter administration would not be and should not be prioritizing human rights in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Southeast Asia and the end of the Vietnam War. And throughout Carter's administration, although Carter himself may have been sympathetic to human rights in other parts of the world and actually did curtail U.S. military assistance to governments in Latin America and was very good, for example, on enforcing an arms embargo against Rhodesia, in Southeast Asia, Carter really continued the policies of the Nixon and Ford administration. Between 1977 and 1979, the Carter administration more than doubled U.S. military aid and sales to Indonesia, precisely at the moment when the atrocities that Indonesia was carrying out, which included mass murder, the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of people, and starvation and disease that killed tens of thousands, was escalating into a genocide. And the Carter administration's response, at least those of his top officials, was to lie before Congress. In the spring of 1977, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke and his deputies lied to Congress and said that Indonesia had effective control of East Timor, that the situation was calm, and that the majority of those who had died had died before Indonesia's invasion. And they used these lies to justify continuing to expand military assistance and weapon sales at a time when congressional human rights supporters and some human rights supporters within his own administration, including the new Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, Patricia Darien, were calling on the Carter administration to halt weapons sales and weapons aid to Indonesia because of the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in East Timor. And the Carter administration's response was pretty illuminating. The CIA in the spring of 1977 and into 1978 told the Carter administration that Indonesia was literally running out of weapons, running out of bullets and bombs because of the intensity of its bombardment of East Timor, and that the Suharto regime was requesting a doubling of military assistance so it could more effectively prosecute that war. And in 1978, the Carter administration actually increased military sales to Indonesia, including the provision of ground attack fighters such as OV-10 Broncos, A-4 and F-5 ground attack fighters, which the administration knew would be used to bomb and attack the defenseless civilian population of East Timor.
Brad, we just have a minute to go. If you can summarize the presidency to the post-presidency, the post-president Carter, and the human rights framework he put forward that was applied and not applied in different situations.
I think we should acknowledge that President Carter was the first president to elevate human rights to an idea that should guide U.S. foreign policy, at least in theory. I think what he also showed is how difficult it is for even well-intentioned presidents to support human rights when the vast majority of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus believes in a more hawkish foreign policy that's designed to support military dictators around the world with U.S. military aid and sales. And the fact that Carter was not able to sort of elevate human rights as he might have wished in East Timor and Indonesia is a reminder of the challenges that activists and human rights supporters in the U.S. and around the world face in trying to get the United States to actually support human rights and do more than give lip service to the idea that human rights should be a guiding principle in U.S. foreign policy.
Brad Simpson, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of history, University of Connecticut, author of Economists with Guns, Authoritarian Development in U.S.-Indonesian Relations, founded the Indonesia's Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. To see our documentary, Massacre, The Story of East Timor, which I did with journalist Alan Nairn, about one of the great genocides of the late 20th century, that was Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, killing off a third of the population, go to democracynow.org. Next up, will President Biden pardon a longtime immigrant rights leader facing detention and deportation? Stay with us.
Dice que está en el río grande de la Magdalena, en su boca donde se funde el mar. En el páramo de la papa nació esta vena, que Rodrigo de Bastidas bautizó. El nombre de una Palestina, que nació Magdalena, el pueblo de Magdalena. Un pueblito que se llamaba Al-Mashdal, y ahora se llama Migdal. Y ahí se plantó un árbol el 23.
Vio de las Tumbas by Nicholas Jarr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Longtime immigrant rights activist Ravi Ragbir faces deportation and detention Monday when he goes for a check-in with ICE. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement here in New York. Democracy Now! Has covered Ravi's fight to stop his own deportation since 2006. His work as former head of the New Sanctuary Coalition. He came to the U.S. from Trinidad and Tobago 30 years ago, but a 2001 wire fraud conviction made his green card subject to review. Both the judge and the prosecutor in his case said Ravi was a low-level employee who was a, quote, casualty of a con artist. And the judge told him, quote, you're not a criminal, and I know that I am never going to see you again, he said. Ravi Ragbir is married to a U.S. citizen and has a U.S.-born daughter. But ICE has refused to normalize his status or stop his required check-ins. In 2022, Ravi and his legal team reached a settlement in a First Amendment lawsuit that ICE would not deport him for 3 years as he worked to stay in the U.S. On Wednesday, he rallied with hundreds of immigrant justice activists at the state capitol in Albany to demand lawmakers enact legislation to protect immigrant New Yorkers ahead of Trump's return to office. Ravi's also requested a presidential pardon, but the Biden administration has yet to respond. Faith leaders and others will speak at a vigil Monday outside the ICE office in Manhattan that supports can attend as Ravi checks in. Others are being asked to sign an online petition. Ravi and his lawyer, Alina Das, join us now, along with Ravi's wife. Alina is co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law. Amy Gottlieb is U.S. Migration Director for the American Friends Service Committee. And Ravi Ragbir, I know it is awkward for you because you've spent so many years working on behalf of other people to be here in your own capacity requesting a pardon. Talk about what needs to happen at this point and why you fear on Monday that at your normal check-in, you could be taken.
Well, this, you have to go back to 2018 when it was a normal check-in. We heard and we saw what happened. So we never, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, you're never sure what is going to happen. Once you go into that building, you, your family, your friends, your community don't know if you'll walk back out. And that is a fear we all face, myself, especially on Monday, we'll be facing, on Monday, when I check in. Each day, for the last few, since December 16th, I've had to remember to breathe, right? Remember how to take one step forward. And so it's, I'm in emotional baskets. I've been doing this fight for many years, right? Not about just about me, but about the humanity of the policy, the humanity of the agency, the humanity of how many lives have been destroyed. So you ask me what is going to happen. I actually cannot answer that right now. I will throw it to my attorney, Alina Das, to respond.
So, Alina, it's great to see you again. We've covered this case for years. I went to court in New Jersey when you were there on your free speech case, whether you were being targeted as a migrant rights leader in your own personal situation. Alina, I think you were pregnant at the time, and your kids are now growing up. Explain how Ravi can ultimately not be deported.
Absolutely. So it's been a privilege to be on this journey with Ravi for the past 16 years as his lawyer. And I have watched him fight tirelessly for other people, even when the law gave him so few options to fight for himself. And so that's why this pardon campaign is so important. I was there, with Ravi and Amy in 2018 when ICE tried to take him away in retaliation for his activism. And
all the people marching outside the federal building time after time.
Absolutely. And we had to have that community support and legal intervention just to get him some temporary protection from deportation. And that's now expiring. So we're walking into the check-in on Monday, uncertain of how much time Ravi has left. But the good news is that President Biden can be the one to end this once and for all. He has the power to give Ravi a pardon, and that pardon will ensure that as a green card holder, Ravi will be able to remain here in the U.S. because he's facing a double punishment for a conviction that he received 24 years ago for which he's already served his time. And I'm proud to say that faith leaders who have seen Ravi give to others, who've seen the sacrifices that he has made, they are leading this fight for the pardon. They believe, they have faith that Biden will do the right thing, that Biden will not allow us to face the next 4 years without the people who helped us survive the first Trump administration. They have faith that Biden will do this for everyone. We submitted this pardon 8 years ago. It's been completely vetted and reviewed. The judge who presided over Ravi's criminal conviction and his trial supports the pardon. And so many other elected officials, faith leaders have come out in support. This is a way that we can keep Ravi together with his family to honor the sacrifices that Ravi, that Amy, that the entire community have made over the years, and to show, you know, Ravi is a beacon of hope for so many, and we need this victory right now.
Amy Gottlieb, you're Ravi's wife. You're also head of what? Migration, the U.S. Programs at American Friends Service Committee, a well-known lawyer yourself. I remember when you wrote the piece in the New York Times, when you're fighting for Ravi's First Amendment rights. You two are married. You're married to a U.S. citizen. You have a U.S. citizen daughter. How is this happening right now?
I mean, as Alina said, you know, we have a history of immigration laws that are unforgiving, right? We don't allow people to be able to move forward in their lives if they've ever had even a smallest contact with the criminal legal system. And so,
and in your case, the judge said you were not a criminal. He sentenced you the least possible he could, saying that you were collateral damage of a case. And even the prosecutor talked about you favorably.
Yeah. So, you know, we ask that question all the time. How is this happening? My family asks that question all the time. He's here. We've been married almost 15 years, right? Ravi's been in this struggle for so many years. We are surrounded by community, but we don't know what's going to happen on Monday. And it is unsettling, to say the least. It is exhausting. But we are in it because we truly continue to believe that there is light at the end of this tunnel. There has to be. There absolutely must be. It's why I do the work I do. It's why we all continue to be part of this struggle together, because there's only one way forward.
Ravi, I give you the final word.
The final word is, even though in our fear, in our anxiety, in our uncertainty of what is going to happen, we still need to stand up. We still need to speak up. We still need to hold on to each other. We still need to be there for each other. Even as we go into to the den of lions, unknown of monsters, not knowing what is going to happen, I still have to walk in there. And the people that support me and surround me are walking with me, and that day we need to walk with others who are going through the same. We need to stop what is happening.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We'll certainly report what happens on Monday. President Biden is in office for another, 10 days, and we will be there on every day raising these questions. Ravi Ragbir, his lawyer Lena Das, co-director of Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law, and Amy Gottlieb, U.S. Migration Director for the American Friends Service Committee. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Anjali Kamat, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, our Executive Director Julie Crosby, Becca Staley's our Director, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music and keep your finger on the pulse of Kingston's best music mix.
I'm Trevor from the Arrogant Worms, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Quilt is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queens. If you are interested in the fantastic minds of your peers, check us out on Instagram at